You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org.
Hey, Julia, how you doing?
Good. How are you, Connor?
About as good as one can be.
Yeah, we're all hanging in by a thread, but pushing forward nonetheless.
Yeah, so we'll try to lift people's spirits a little bit with this by talking about, you know, some positive potential possibilities in the future. Before we do that, why don't I introduce us? So I am Connor Eccles, the co-host or the host of the Non-Zero podcast and also the managing editor of the Non-Zero newsletter. And this is, of course, Non-Zero World, which is the podcast that I host each week and the weekend edition of the Non-Zero podcast. You are Julia Gledhill, a research associate at the Stimson Center, where you focus on Pentagon spending and weapons acquisition. And you're also a co-host of the Undiplomatic podcast, which is very fun because we had another one of your co-hosts on a couple weeks ago. So the synergy only grows between our shows. Very exciting. Very exciting stuff.
Love that.
Yeah. But I brought you on because you're a perfect person to talk about the fact that for the first time in a long time, there's a real conversation about making cuts to the Pentagon budget that seems at least somewhat serious. And maybe you'll be able to tell me whether or not there is any seriousness there. But, you know, between the potential DOGE related cuts, you know, whether or not those are serious, and Pete Hegseth starting to, the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth starting to talk about the possibility of cutting certain programs, there's a real possibility of at least substantial change in weapons acquisition, whether or not that is going to bring down the defense budget. So I thought I'd bring you on to tell people kind of how you might actually go about cutting the defense budget if you were so inclined. But before we dive into the details, I thought it might be helpful for you to lay out for our listeners a little bit. You know, it's interesting because the budget in real terms is about as high as it's been in like 40, 50 years, right? The only time that it was higher in inflation-adjusted terms was during the like early 2010s. And that's kind of crazy because we're actually not in a war right now, or at least not in an active large-scale war. So can you explain a little bit how the budget has gotten so big?
Yeah, it's a big question. But, you know, I mean, the United States has been committed at global military dominance at all costs for a very long time now. And it gets increasingly logistically difficult to maintain, and it's incredibly expensive. So throughout, you know, the Cold War and then the War on Terror, you have this sort of like big bad enemy to sort of mobilize around. Now it's China under the sort of realm of great power competition as justification for ever more Pentagon spending, even as, you know, the sort of size of the military forces have decreased as far as military participation. And also, you know, like we've seen this in acquisition terms as well, where the arms industry is doing less, you know, like we have fewer programs. They perform much more poorly in terms of like both cost and schedule. You know, the arms makers are sort of delivering these capabilities late and over budget. And that has, you know, a real impact on sort of military readiness. This is the sort of wonderful case of the F-35, which people always point to, which is that it has a 30% mission capable rate. You know, it's like you have growing budgets, but decreasing military readiness. And all of that is because of this project of primacy, which is just difficult. And it isn't terribly strategically rational, right? And so that's, you know, the main reason that we have such incredible levels of military spending. And the biggest proponents of increases to the military budget think that it's not enough, right? They think that the industrial base is deteriorated. And for that reason, we need to spend even more. And they assume that more money would necessarily like change, you know, global politics, balance of power in a way that's positive for the United States. And I think that's a really big assumption behind our sort of budgeting and strategy on, you know, national security. So obviously it's a big question. Like, the war on terror played a really big role. We could talk about like sort of the largesse associated with military contracting and service contracting, not just in the military, but also at the Pentagon. But, you know, the main reason is like we have this incredibly expensive and difficult privacy project that doesn't really make much sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So if I'm understanding you right, then the basic problem, right, is that we have an infinite sort of desire to spend on the military or very big goals that require a lot of spending. And that sort of leads to all kinds of undisciplined behavior from a financial perspective. Is that basically how it ends up happening?
Yeah, I think that that's a fair characterization. And simultaneously, as you spend more on the Pentagon and military contractors who take home, you know, about half, a little more than half, depending on sort of the estimates that you look at, of Pentagon dollars on an annual basis, those companies have incredible power and they continue to concentrate their power and thus their influence on the defense policymaking process. And that's part of why there will always be a reason to increase military spending, whether it's, you know, the Soviet Union, whether it's international terrorism, whatever that means to you, which is basically, you know, a supercharged political term that people wield at their disposal. And then, you know, there's China. And so there's always going to be threat inflation. That's the story of a financialized and corrupted defense policy process where you have an industry that extracts value from the economy. And in order to do that, it has to, you know, really influence and bend Congress to its will, which they absolutely do in more ways than one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we should come back. We should come back, obviously, to all of these sort of big picture things. But I think it might be useful to drill down a little bit on specific programs. So you and some of your colleagues at the Stimson Center wrote a piece recently talking about ways in which we could cut right now with minimal sort of impacts, not even changing the top level aspects necessarily of how we approach the military, but just the actual logistical things that we're paying for, how we could cut about $60 billion in each year in coming years. So can you talk about some of the sort of big programs there? I guess maybe a good place to start would be the infamous F-35.
Totally. And key point that I'm really grateful that you mentioned, which is that, like, you know, we could make much deeper cuts if we did, in fact, spark a grand strategic shift in foreign policy and sort of rethought the extent of our sort of, you know, defense plans and under this veil of primacy and the pursuit of dominance in every corner of the world. So that's really important. You know, we thought about getting into force structure and we were sort of like, okay, that's like a beast of its own. Because, you know, ideally, like, the best way to really deeply cut the military budget is to restructure the armed forces pretty significantly. But to your point, like, on a more tactical level, if the Trump administration is in fact very interested in, you know, efficiency or cutting waste, you know, we have just a slew of acquisition failures to sort of look toward as, you know, a model of how to go about cutting unnecessary and dangerous weapons from the U.S. military. The F-35 is the best example, the one that we always go back to because it's the most expensive weapon program in U.S. history. Current number for its lifetime cycle cost is $1.7 trillion. And the sort of original sin of the F-35 program is that it was designed to do many things and it doesn't do any of them particularly well, whether that be flying low and slow and also high and fast as like a bomber, but also theoretically aircraft that could also do close air support for ground troops in combat, should that ever be required. And so, you know, we talk about the F-35 because it was designed to be this multi-purpose aircraft. And as a result, you know, it's not good at anything. And it has a lot of design flaws as a result. So you hear industry talk a lot about the requirements process and why, you know, requirements should be easier and simpler and more streamlined so that like programs move forward quicker and whatever, all of the usual talking points. What's frustrating about that is that, you know, it is true that requirements are kind of like at the core of a lot of sort of acquisition failures. It's the same story for the Littoral Combat Ship, which we actually didn't include in this brief, but is another sort of example of a weapon program that was designed to like do many things. It was supposed to be this sort of like agile near shore capability, but also like go into the deeps. It just like doesn't make sense. And when you do multi-purpose, weapon programs like that, the sort of biggest problem is that it doesn't give service members the opportunity to like train for all of those purposes, right? So like an F-35 pilot, to get in the training hours needed to like do all of those things well, like low and slow, high and fast, that's a pretty high threshold. And if, you know, you're designing a really technologically complex aircraft, there's going to be issues, which is why like then you have all these design flaws, it can't fly, then service members can't train, right? Like that's like sort of one of the core reasons. And so we talk about the F-35 as means to, you know, cut a lot of waste. We talk about being able to, you know, rely on existing programs in order to sort of fill the capability gap. But, you know, we also talk about aircraft carriers, which are super, you know, vulnerable to attack and expensive. And these are sort of just like a couple of the sort of high level weapon programs that, you know, you could save billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars. And then in addition, we sort of get into some of the nuclear weapons that the United States doesn't need and that are incredibly strategically destabilizing. We talk about right. The Sentinel, the ground-based leg of the nuclear triad, and the sort of modernization effort, which is what the Sentinel program is, to sort of make, you know, a new generation of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And the reason we sort of dig in there is mainly because, you know, ICBMs, super dangerous. You can't take them back once they're launched, right? It incentivizes like first strikes, because like, you know, it's also very vulnerable because it's stationary. You know, people know where they are. They're in the Midwest. They're in like these big silos that can't move, as opposed to a submarine, for example. And so they're pretty dangerous. We don't need them. And, you know, on the latter point, we have other nuclear capabilities that are a lot less vulnerable to attack. And now in this day and age, some say are, you know, more accurate. So that's sort of why we argue against the Sentinel program and sort of point toward the fact that that program has experienced, you know, 81% cost growth since 2020, and yet the Pentagon has greenlit its continuation when the strategic rationale, the strategic justification for the ICBM is just, it's not there. And it is just like the biggest boondoggle and, you know, a product of a very powerful nuclear weapons lobby. So, you know, we have these huge programs. We have, you know, aircraft carriers. We have the land-based leg of the triad. We have the F-35 program. Like those alone, you know, would save a bunch of money. And it's funny because you see Elon now jumping on the train on the F-35, but I'll believe it when I see it, you know?
Yeah. That is the tricky part is there is so much to be cut. Well, and also with the kind of tech crowd, you wonder if the goal is to sort of just get their clients in. Maybe that's something we can talk about more with the sort of logistics of all of this. I am curious. So you, like the Sentinel one is particularly interesting because my understanding is that it actually did. It's a non-McCurdy breach. Isn't that what it's called? Right. Do you want to explain what that is? So it's already violated the rules that are supposed to be in place for preventing price gouging, basically, or like inflation.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's non-McCurdy is a mechanism through which, Congress can, like, sort of trigger reviews of a program that experiences significant cost growth, you know, depending on the reason. And there's sort of like, there are clear sort of guidelines as to, like, how the Pentagon has to assess whether or not a program should be continued after a critical cost breach. And, you know, one of those considerations is this like easily replaceable? And, you know, is it critical for quote unquote national security? Which anytime you see like, is this critical to national security? It should raise red flags because everything under the sun is national security these days. So right. It's just like this ambiguous term. And, you know, of course, you're going to see the Pentagon greenlight the continuation of a program. And, that they have vested interests in, and that industry has vested interests in. And, you know, you have this powerful ICBM lobby and lawmakers and, you know, the ICBM states who, you know, have political constituencies tied up in this stuff. So, yeah, it's like, I mean, the mechanisms in place, unfortunately, have not reined in costs. And that is the story of acquisition in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just really crazy. Yeah, I wonder too, I mean, you know, how does all of this relate to the fact that, so like one of the things that you mentioned cutting or that would be good for cuts is that there's an extraordinary bureaucracy of contractors rather than government employees that do an enormous amount of the work that actually kind of makes the Pentagon run. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the way in which the privatization of a lot of defense assets has contributed to this increase in prices?
Yeah, totally. So this was actually funny because I like very offhand tweeted that private contractors are more expensive than federal employees like a couple weeks ago. And it randomly went viral, and I've never gone viral before, but it was like, it was crazy. I got like 14,000 likes and like, wow, 24 hours. And I had all these people angry in my replies saying like, oh, like actually, like you look at FTE equivalent and like da 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 full-time employee equivalent. And no, like, you know, industry is so much more efficient. It's so much more, you know, productive and all these things. And it really reflected this just like deeply ingrained, like belief, like deeply held belief that, you know, government is this like slow and arduous and like unproductive, like, you know, entity full of just leeches. Like the comments were just insane. And it was very, I think, indicative of like the American psyche, I guess. And like the way that we sort of revere business and like this weird way. But, you know, there have been like multiple studies over the years that have showed that, you know, in the context of the Pentagon, service contracting is a lot more expensive. That is because the government is outsourcing its most basic administrative functions. And I'm talking about IT. I'm talking about like equipment maintenance, like medical support, like on site, like basic stuff. And it's like, it's, I think, partly wrapped up in this just sort of rise of like the consulting class and like this idea that, you know, people who specialize or like quote unquote specialize or like do a different project every 3 weeks like are somehow going to be better at you know, the things that full-time employees do all the time. So anyways, like this is a bit of a rant, but yeah, I mean, like the biggest area that we talked about in terms of saving money at the Pentagon was service contracting. The Defense Business Board did study about this a few years ago. My former employer, the Project and Government Oversight, has studied this issue. Like it could literally be like some $26 billion a year just by reducing the, you know, service contracting workforce by like 15%. Like it's very significant. And it's kind of counterintuitive to folks like Elon, who are now, you know, taking Doge to the Pentagon, which they were no rush to get there, and, you know, talking about laying off probationary employees and like, you know, Doge, from how I see it, is like very much going after federal employees. And I don't necessarily even think, like, people are saying, oh, they're going to gut the government and then gut everything else because you got to get rid of the people first, I guess. And it's not about efficiency. It's about small government. But like, I'm not even really convinced that it's about small government necessarily. I think it's about privatizing everything, that we're like, you're going to see maybe like some of these services backfilled by more private contractors, like more service contractors doing, again, like basic functions of a government agency. So yeah, I, you know, I really can't stress this point enough that like, yes, like, you know, it's not across the board the case necessarily that federal employees are always going to be cheaper, but like this, I think, has been really well demonstrated for the Pentagon specifically.
Yeah, well, that kind of brings me to another thing I wanted to talk about, which is that I guess an interesting aspect of the Trump administration is that they are either talking to or bringing in a lot of people that are themselves, or, you know, themselves claim to be interested in reforming the acquisitions process that the Pentagon uses, right? That are interested in making things more efficient, in protecting, you know, protecting the government from price gouging, things like that. And that's a lot of the stuff that you work on. But my sense is that these sort of guys that are coming mainly from Silicon Valley, you know, even some of the people at higher levels like Steven Feinberg, the incoming Deputy Secretary of Defense, who maybe has a different vision for these things. But I guess, could you lay out a little bit, you know, to the extent that you followed this, the ways in which they're trying to adjust the approach that, like defense tech in general, and that these types of people are trying to do to change the approach that we have for contracting, and why you think that may or may not be a good idea?
Yes. Thrilled you asked, because few people want to talk about that acquisition process. It's not the most fun or sexy topic, but yeah, so it's really interesting because you have the likes of Palantir who love to rag on the primes, love to, you know,
the primes being the big, like Northrop Grumman and Raytheon and stuff.
The big five. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you love, you know, you love to see people ragging on the primes, and then you look a little bit closer and you realize that they're actually all on board together with this so-called idea of, you know, acquisition reform, which is really just deregulation. It is deregulation of the weapon acquisition process so that there are fewer guardrails in place for the Pentagon to, you know, ascertain whether an emerging technology, for example, is in fact necessary, cost-effective, you know, and like safe to pursue, right? Like in terms of stability, in terms of like the risk of arms racing, like what have you. And it's so interesting because it's like, you know, Palantir, whatever, and you know, Northrop Grumman and the big ones are all likewise pushing this effort, which in Congress is being led by Senator Wicker, who is the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He has a big bill called the Forged Act that he introduced like right before the holidays, kind of under the radar, but has, you know, an accompanying report and had a hearing about it last month, if I remember correctly. And, you know, the top lines are basically make rapid acquisition pathways the default, as opposed to like your program of record, like more sort of demanding like oversight process for like a significant weapon acquisition program. And by that, I mean like a major one, like a very high value one. And then the second sort of top line from that bill of this, like, you know, legislative effort to, again, like push forward acquisition reform, which is a decades old project that we can talk about. But the second sort of top line is not only rely on rapid acquisition pathways, but also make like quote unquote commercial contracting the default. And by commercial contracting, I mean make everything, you know, a quote unquote commercial, like subject to a commercial product or item process. The reason that matters is because if you get a contract, if say you're you know, Palantir, you're selling whatever they sell, data analytic AI stuff, Maven, I don't know.
Yeah, no one really knows. No one really knows what Palantir sells. I've spent a lot of time reading about, I'm reading a book, I don't have it here. I'm reading a book by Alex Karp, the CEO right now, and even he's not really saying what they do.
It's wild. I mean, like, I know they have like a lot, like 40% or something of their revenues last year were Army contracts, like, or were government contracts, and most of that was Army contracts. Like, it's the Project Maven, it's like the Titan thing that like like reconnaissance vehicle. Yeah, they like, they do, I don't know. I still don't totally get it either. But you know, the reason that Palantir would want to sell a service or a product to the Pentagon that the department considers commercial is because when you sell a commercial item or service, you are not required to provide the Pentagon with certified cost and pricing data. And so when you're negotiating a contract, you know, you kind of want to know like what, you know, the person who you might award this contract to, what their costs are, right? Not because you don't want them to make any money, but because you want to see how much, just in general, like ballpark profit margin, right? Like, you wouldn't hire someone to like redo your roof without looking into materials costs and checking their work to make sure they're not like, you know, charging you 10 times the price of, you know, a fair and reasonable cost of a shingle. You know what I'm saying? Like the same thing applies to government contracting, to military contracting. And so what Roger Wicker, the Silicon Valley firms, you know, and the primes, they're all on board with this. They're all on board with basically getting rid of the guardrails in place to protect the Pentagon from unfair prices. Like, plain and simple, there's a couple different ways that you like can try to attain fair and reasonable prices. And one of them is you know, narrowing what's considered commercial, which, like, again, the industry has sort of pushed Congress to artificially expand the definition of what's considered commercial. And now they're just like, let's toss it completely. You know, free market it all under the like sort of operating theory that, like, you know, if it's commercial, then it's price competitive. But the problem with that is that, like, you know, what the Pentagon considers commercial right now, like by statute or whatever, it's not, it doesn't even have to be sold to the public. So, yeah, I don't want to get too in the weeds or anything, but that's sort of the top line. And it's part of like a decades long effort to just deregulate weapon acquisition and sort of open the floodgates to the Pentagon buying whatever industry sells them, you know, under the strategic rationale, China, China, China.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's just interesting because, I mean, I get, you know, there's such a clear need for reform in the process, right? Like, what, you know, the programs that you talk about, the F-35, you know, for example, is one of these where, for example, the intellectual property belongs to the company that's producing it, right? And they are the one in charge of also the maintenance contract, which is enormous, and all these different things that are problematic. But it's interesting because they are coming in and saying, yes, we want to reform this, but I guess what I'm hearing from you is that they're approaching it in a way that could actually make the problem worse.
Yeah, well, what they're saying is, like, the Pentagon is too difficult to work with and the rules are too hard to follow and it's bad for competition because the small firms can't, don't have the administrative wherewithal to navigate the bureaucracy, you know, blah, 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 blah. So we should just cut all of it. We should, you know, cut all of the, you know, proverbial red tape so that industry can do its thing and deliver. The problem with that is that it's just, it's, there's very little evidence behind the argument that, for example, providing cost and pricing data slows down the contracting process, that it's somehow like very, like, you know what your costs are. Like, what do you mean? And all this sort of studies on this, like, oh, like what slows down, you know, contracting, like, you know, there was the State of Industrial Base report in like 2022 from the Pentagon. And then there was this other contract finance study they published in like 2023, I believe. And it's like, they never study the role of industry in slowing down the military contracting process. Elizabeth Warren has talked a lot about this and written about it. And the senator basically says, like, you know, you have contractors who, even when they are required to give cost and pricing data, so that a contracting officer at the Pentagon can be like, oh, okay, this seems reasonable. Like, their profit margin is probably about this. So, you know, this, like, let's award them this contract or whatever. You know, even when they are required to give that information, you know, there's evidence that contractors will kind of like sabotage the negotiation process by like waiting to give it, or like then waiting after like a certain period and then dumping all this information on a contracting officer. And then you have administrative sort of constraints within the Pentagon. Like, there's just so many issues. And it's always the industry line. It's always bureaucracy, bureaucracy, bureaucracy. And they do capitalize on kernels of truth, which, like, yeah, the requirements process does suck. Why? Because, you know, the likes of Lockheed Martin never should have taken the contract to do the F-35. I mean, the Pentagon never should put it out there either. Why? Because the requirements of that program were crazy. It, like, they didn't, it was setting the industry and the Pentagon up for failure to design an aircraft like that. And, you know, the people who made that decision retired, like, in the next whatever, like, within the decade. So it's like, cool, now that there are kids, you know, in the military right now who are younger than the F-35 program. And it's crazy. And it's like mortgaging our future on these weapon programs made possible by an acquisition system that encourages failure. And that's what acquisition reform will do too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to pull back in a second here and talk about the big picture, talk about, you know, future programs, talk about China, things like that. But before, maybe it would be helpful if you want to lay out one or two of the big reforms that you would make or that you would suggest for the acquisitions process, and how those might be able to sort of tamp down on some of the issues that we've been discussing.
Yeah. So I would like drastically narrow the commercial definition because we have contractors that aren't giving the Pentagon cost and pricing information that it needs to negotiate fair prices on military contracts. This is legalized price gouging, to be clear. When we see an expanded commercial definition or the eradication of whatever, like, you know, these requirements completely, which some people want, you know, that is legalized price gouging, which is why this is like so hard to track as an issue. We have to like sort of wait for IGs to like do their, and it takes so long. So I would narrow the commercial item definition. And I would also lower the threshold, the mandatory disclosure threshold at which, you know, other contractors have to give this cost and pricing information. So it's not just like there's a couple different ways that you're required or not required to give cost and pricing information. And those are sort of two ways that industry has skirted requirements to provide, you know, important cost information needed to negotiate fair prices. This is like, you know, been the subject of investigations by like CBS and like Bloomberg's talked about it. And, you know, what happens is like you find, large contractors just end up settling on like when they are found defective pricing, they just settle. And it's way cheaper and probably like makes more sense for them financially to do that than it is to just like follow the rules. So it's like lawmakers have bent to the will of industry and gutted important regulations, and they need to be reinstated and strengthened.
Yeah. So why don't we go ahead and pull back a little bit? So you've written a lot about how competition with China can lead to major increases in the Pentagon budget, drives our spending. Can you talk about that relationship in a little bit more detail between sort of this emerging consensus? You know, some people get mad about the word consensus, but this emerging view that we need to have intense competition with China, prepare for a potential war, and how that will affect the budget.
Yeah, I think Ollie Wine is the one who wrote that piece. It's like, it's not a consensus. Like, people are pushing back. I have the Rivalry Peril right here too, Van and my friend's new book. So there are people pushing back on this idea that we need to do great power competition. And it's interesting. So I guess the best way to answer your question, in my view, is sort of like...
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.